Accession number 10161, reel number 2.
Colonel Slater, reel 2. I think we've looked up a book that you've got there. Could you tell me its name?
Yes. The man and the name of the book is the Northern 1st Battalion of the Northern Rhodesia Regiment in Malaya, 1954-1956, written by the intelligence officer David Bales. And looking up in that, I see that the man in black was not Osman China, but his name was Ah Tuk Fuk, a communist terrorist, Chinese communist terrorist. He later gave himself up. The other person I mentioned was a man called Osman China, half Chinese and half Malaya. He was the responsible for the Malay District Committee in working in Benta South area.
Did you hear of many people who were Malays or partial Malays working with the guerrillas?
Yes, as a matter of fact, they were, and they were in the area of where we were operating now, Kuala Lipis, Benta area. There were a number of Malay communists, terrorists.
By the way, referring back to this book, I think it's a very rare one, is it not?
It is indeed. There are only about 8 copies of it. As you can see, it's typed, that's all. It's never been printed, because the demand for it would not make it economic to have it printed and published.
Can you tell me how you and your unit set about its work in the Kuala Lipis area on arrival, how you went about it?
Well, I can only speak from my personal experience. We arrived at Kuala Lipis by train. We got into our vehicles, drove to Benta, as I said, about 8 miles outside Kuala Lipis, perhaps not as far as that. We were given an hour, I suppose, to get ourselves sorted out in our tents, and then within 2 hours of arrival at Benta, B Company, I led my company into the jungle, and that was the amount of time that we were given, and another company went in the next day to take over from 2KL.
So you would just patrol about the jungle, would you?
Yes. We went into the jungle in the area that the CO had given us, that gave us an area to patrol. We established our base. We went to the same 2KL base camp, and we stayed the night there, and they then packed up and went back to Benta to go back home to Africa, and we took over the patrolling.
Which particular officer did you take over from of the 2nd KAR?
I took over from B Company commander, a very great friend of mine by the name of... I took over from D Company, a very great friend of mine was the company commander by the name of Dennis Ford. Very interesting to note that when I was adjutant of the 5th Loyals TA in Bolton, Dennis Ford was the adjutant of the 5th King's Own in Lancaster. That's where we first met, and we were friends from that day on.
What kind of briefing did Ford give you about what they had experienced over the preceding period in the area?
We went out on a patrol together to give a feel of the ground in his particular area. Not a long patrol, but a patrol. And he briefed me very thoroughly and of the areas that they had patrolled themselves and the feel of the country and where they thought that perhaps the CTs were passing through or coming back.
Did he give you the impression that they had been on top of the situation, that guerrilla activity was declining or rising?
I think, looking back on it now, it was the fact, it was the impression I got was that it was in a declining situation, in that the battalion had got on top of the area and the CTs were very anxious to pack up.
Did you find that yourself, that once you got there, that this was an accurate portrayal of the situation?
Yes. I think it's safe to say that the African battalions were not feared, but were treated with respect by the CTs when they came into the area, because they knew they were very good trackers and they were very good jungle bashers.
Can you tell me some details about how a patrol would be organised and conducted?
Yes. In the each morning, one would decide that you were going to have, say, two patrols from a platoon, and the platoon commander, you'd have your platoon commander there with his patrol commanders. Patrol would normally be about a section, eight or nine men, and the area would be looked at, and we would all discuss where we think we should go. The platoon commander would enlarge upon that. All the section commanders would be there all round in this little O group, and we would ask the section commanders if they had any points, how long they should be out for. They should be leaving, say, certain time and be back at a certain time. We didn't ever have very rarely did we have patrols staying out a night unless they were on a specified ambush. They would be back, say, at about 3:30 in the afternoon, because although the sun wouldn't go down till, say, 5:30, 6, in the jungle, of course, it gets very much darker earlier. You're in gloom most of the time, so they'd be back in the base camp, say, about 3:30.
What was the character of the vegetation in the area?
It varied. Pahang was thick jungle. We did another operation from Pahang called Operation Rooster up in the Cameron Highlands, where the SAS had been, and that was extremely tough going. Very little cleared areas where they'd, and that was deep in Aboriginal country. We came across quite a lot of the original Aboriginals in Operation Rooster, but it's difficult to say. Some areas when we went out on patrol weren't even marked on the map; they would just be a white blank. And one interesting time was that one of our patrols reported back that he'd fallen off the end of his map because there was nothing on it. It was just a big square of whiteness that had not yet been surveyed.
Did patrols get lost then in areas like that, or generally speaking?
Oh, yes. I myself, with one of my patrols, got lost. We were not sure where we were, and the answer to that was to radio back to battalion headquarters and asked for a Oster to pinpoint the area. And you would agree on a certain time where the Oster thought he would be. You waited out to see if you could hear him. And at that certain time that you'd agreed upon, you would send up a smoke flare. Of course, this billows through the jungle canopy, and is seen for quite a long distance away from the air. And the Auster would then, once he'd seen the smoke, he'd come over and you'd get in, net onto his radio, and he would say, yes, I'll fix it for you. And he would circle around taking the bearings and report back that he thought that you were in square so and so. It's a rather interesting little episode that again happened to me when the Auster came over, and we had, I think we were about 2 miles out where we thought we would have been. We had a vague idea of where we were, and we asked for this spotting from the Auster, and he came over and did his circling and radioed us back and said, yes, I think you are in A, B, C, D, E, F, shall we say. And I looked at my map and I said, no, we cannot be in A, B, C, D, E, F. I think we are at X, Y, Z, square X, Y, Z, or, you see. And he went round again. He said, no, no, you must be in A, B, C, D, E, F. I said, I do not think so. And then just then he said, I'm very sorry. You're quite right. You're where you are. I've got my map upside down.
Were there many rubber estates in the area?
Kuala Lumpur, yes, quite a number. And especially when we got to down to Johor, our last camp was at just outside Kluang. Well, of course, there are lots of rubber estates there, and you had to go through rubber estates to get to the jungle, which is a bit, that was unfortunate, because if you marched through, you were seen by the tappers, and if there were any CTs about, they knew you were about, you were going on patrol. So what we did, we would go out at very, very early in the morning by motor transport, and we would try not to stop the vehicles, but to go very slowly and jump off the back of the vehicle so that the vehicle didn't stop. We would then collect, the vehicles would drive on and way back to camp, and we would get into the and through into the off the road through the rubber plantation and be in the jungle before the tappers had arrived, and anybody up at night hearing the transport, but because the transport didn't stop, we hoped, assume that nobody had actually been got off, but we're just going round to another place.
Did that work?
I think it had an effect, yes.
Can you describe any contacts which you had in the jungle in the Kuala Lumpur area?
Well, I can only describe that immediate one, which we had within 5 minutes. One of my platoons later was out with the mortar platoon, and where they had two kills. But I myself never actually thereafter was involved in a contact in the jungle. Although my company had our kills, we got 6 kills altogether. 5 of those were from set ambushes when a platoon went out and was told by Special Branch that there would be that day or the next day a CT was expected to come in to meet somebody in one of the villages, and the ambushes were set up on the railway or the path or the area in which the CT was expected. And I had 2 very successful platoon ambushes set up, one of which we got 2 CTs in the first and 3 in the other.
Can you describe what happened in those ambushes, even though you weren't there?
Yes, as far as I recall, the The one in which we had three kills was near a railway line. I can't quite remember where we were then. Temelo, I think it was, near Temelo. And we were given this hot information by a special branch that there would be a party coming in either that night or early next morning, making its way up along the railway line to come to the local village. I sent out a platoon patrol who went out in the early morning of the day previous, where they remained in ambush positions during the whole of the day. And in ambush positions, it's not much fun, because you can't get around and walk around. Once you've set yourself down, you have to stay there, and it's not till the evening that you can withdraw from the ambush positions and have a meal or something like that. They stayed there the whole day, stayed there the night. They got obviously went back into ambush positions during the night, and it was in the early morning of the second day that they heard noises coming up by the side of the railway. They were all ready, of course, and as these three figures passed them, they let them get well into the ambush, and then they were shot, all three shot dead immediately. Roger Briley, the platoon commander, then brought them back. You have to bring your CTs back, your dead CTs. They were all strapped to a pole, and they walked up through the railway line to my company headquarters, and then taken off from there by special branch.
Earlier on, you were talking about the names of guerrillas. Did you have much information about them as individuals, their names and age and background, and the names of units, guerrilla units, and so on?
Yes, the Malayan Special Branch, where my limited experience of them, were very good. Most of what you asked me was done at battalion headquarters by the commanding officer and the intelligence officer, and they would have a complete list with photographs even of the local CT groups in a particular area. Very well researched by the special branch. You knew who they were, you had their faces and their background, where they'd come from. It was 95% accurate.
How much support do you think they were getting from local people?
Well, they existed from local people. They were supported by the tappers, or they'd go to these villages, which were defended, of course, with barbed wire, but obviously life had to go on, and people would leave them in the morning to go to work and that sort of thing. And they would carry food, drop them off in the side of the road or into the jungle or the rubber plantation at a selected spot. And the CTs would then come in that night or the next morning and pick up the food and disappear into deep jungle. That's how they really existed.
Do you think the local people were doing this voluntarily or under coercion?
I think a bit of both. But it was gradually dying away. They saw that the insurrection, the communist insurrection, was no longer the thing it was, and support was gradually drifting away from them.
Would your troops conduct searches to prevent food being passed?
No, we never conducted any searches. That was, as far as I know, was left to the Malay police to carry that out.
What did you observe or think of this system of trying to separate the population from the guerrillas by getting the population into these villages?
I think it was the correct answer. and it worked wonders, because the villager got a sense of security. They had their own home guard. They were wired in, if you like, at night, but they could still walk around their village and communicate with their friends and neighbours. But they weren't allowed outside, and I think it was a most successful policy brought in by General Templer, which really brought the emergency to the end.
Was this system in operation in Kuala Lipis when you arrived?
Not in Kuala Lipis itself, but in the villages round about, yes. They would be.
Did the local people resent the system, or did they accept it, or what?
No. You're talking about Kuala Lipis. Kuala Lipis was mainly a Malay town. So there, by and large, the Chinese CTs, weren't getting much support from them, although, as I told you previously, there were a fair amount of Malay CTs in that area. It was down in when we were in Kluang that you had more of the Chinese tappers, more Chinese in Johor state, and it was there that you had your more villagers with their enclosures. Is that what you asked me?
Well, I was asking about the attitude of the people who were in these new villages, whether they resented being put in them.
No, I don't think so. As I said, I think they got a great sense of security from it, and I don't think there was any resentment at all.
Were the guerrillas stronger in the Kuala Lipis area or in the Johor area?
No, they were stronger in the Johor area. They were very tough down there still, even towards the end of the campaign. And in fact, when shortly before we got down there, I can't give you exact dates, but the Fijis, who had been operating in that area, suffered some quite bad casualties there in ambushes on the main road.
How would guerrilla strength show itself in the Johor area?
I'm not really quite capable of answering that. As I said, all the special branch information would come to battalion headquarters, and we were simply told that there is a certain gang, if you like, band, operating in a certain area, suspected that it was controlled by whoever, the local suspect, and we would go on from there. And there were, as far as I can remember, there were a large number of these people still operating in the area. But there were quite a number of other troops there.
Would the guerrillas show much offensive spirit in either of the two areas?
No, they were not. They were, I think, even the CTs were beginning to realise that the writing was on the wall, and most of it was keeping the morale of their own comrades up. It might be interesting, getting back to Kluang and whether it was stronger down there. Yes, it was, and I now recall, I should have remembered this earlier, in that when we were down there, the battalion, the Queens, and another, the West Yorks, I'm not sure about my facts here, but certainly we took part in the largest helicopter airlift into the jungle when we went down to Kluang, and a whole brigade was flown into various parts of the jungle round Kluang, and an airlift like that had never taken place before of such intensity.
Was it successful?
Yes, it was the start of our last operation, and we got a number of kills in the area.
How did the helicopters perform? Were there any breakdowns or crashes?
No crashes whilst carrying troops. We got on very well with them. We had a naval squadron who came to us and did a lot of airlifting for us, and the RAF, of course. But I had an interesting episode that happened to my company, or to me personally, when we were at Kuala Krau on the Pahang River, and we had some Royal Engineers attached to us carrying out a survey, and they were to be paid one day, and their helicopter came up Kluang River. We were standing on the wharf on the quayside, the little quay there that was at this Kuala Krau, and we saw the helicopter coming up river, fairly low, what, 40 feet, I suppose, following the river, when all of a sudden the tail rotor came off, and of course the helicopter went straight into the river. There was four people on board. We managed to jump into canoes and rescue them. One of them, a staff sergeant in the Royal Engineers, was carried downriver a good 400 yards, I suppose, and we just got to him in time. The others we got to earlier, and then we took them, four of them, back to my company mess, where we plied them with rum and whiskey and revived their spirits. The unfortunate part about it was that the local RE section didn't get paid, because all the money went down to the bottom of the river.
Was there any bombing of the jungle?
Oh yes, there was a lot of bombing of the jungle, and a lot of artillery and mortar support. For instance, at Kuala Lipis and also at Kluang, when one would go into the jungle, you would be given certain map squares where you would not be allowed to go into for, say, a week or 3 or 4 days, because during that week or 3 or 4 days, it would be bombed, or it would be mortared, or it would be artillery fired. So you kept out of that. They were out of bounds to you, as it were. And then once that day had gone, or that 3 days had gone, then you could go in to search. How successful it was, I really couldn't tell you.
I was asking you about the offensive spirit, or lack of it, amongst the guerrillas, but whilst you were in Malaya, were the guerrillas in your areas trying to cause economic damage?